Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, where each time out we listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to make sure that our veterans know we honor and appreciate their service and sacrifice, that we want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, I think you'll agree by the end of this hour, we're going to be educated and maybe even inspired by some of the things we'll hear about today from 87-year-old Vernon Conrad of Reedley, California. Served in the 25th Infantry Division during World War II. If you're from the Fresno area, maybe you remember the three terms he spent on the Fresno County Board of Supervisors. But that never would have happened if he didn't make it home from the Pacific during World War II. Let's go back to those days. Now, you can paint a good picture because when I ask veterans, well, what was it like back then in their hometown? For you, it was, what was it like on this property? Because these 40 acres of fruit orchards we're sitting in right now is right where you were born, I understand.
That's right. There have been a lot of changes made, that's for sure. But it's a great place to live, and I wouldn't want to live anyplace else. And my wife and I have redone things. In fact, we built this house that we're in, laid a lot of the bricks myself. So there's some feelings that go with, you know, where you are, and enjoyed Reedley. And of course, it was only a little over 3,000 population back then. And I really like that better than they do now.
There are a lot of people out there echoing what you just said, I'm sure, as they listen. And I have to imagine, just looking at all the peach trees as I drove in, I imagine you've picked a lot of peaches off some of those trees. How old do you think you were when you got sent out there to start picking?
Golly, I don't know how old really, but I know I picked in crews time I was a junior in high school. I've picked peaches and picked grapes and plums and nectarines, and I've done all of this kind of farm work before it was fashionable to be a farm worker. That was the way we survived. We didn't hire a lot of labor then. We pretty well did our own, and with a little help. But now it's somewhat different, where owners and operators don't do too much of their own labor. But things do change, you know.
Absolutely. What can you tell me about the atmosphere here in Reedley in December of 1941? So you would have been 15 years old. You're a high school student at the time. Do you remember how you found out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
I don't remember. It happened on a Sunday, and we had a radio, but we never turned it on very much. When I really felt the impact of it was on the bus going to school Monday morning. That's when I really realized that something really terrific had happened. And then when we got to school, we had an assembly. The principal of the high school got all the students together and informed us of what had happened. And undoubtedly, there would be a whole lot of changes made rather quickly, and they were. We all the rest of the time when I was in high school, we had no night games or anything. They were all in the daytime because we were in blackout conditions here in the valley. They weren't supposed to have lights at night. Some thought that their Japanese might continue to the coast and attack here.
Well, and I've talked to some folks who are in some of the towns around here during that time, and they remember having Japanese-American classmates, and then all of a sudden those classmates were gone a few months later. Is that what happened here in Reedley?
That's correct. All of the Japanese were required to pack up in very short time, and were shipped most all out of California. And we had a lot of my friends who were classmates in school. They were soon gone. So tremendous upheaval. Whether it was good or bad, or whether it was necessary, I don't know. But it happened. That's just part of the things that happened because of war.
And just trying to put myself in your shoes, and, you know, having these classmates pulled out of school and sent somewhere else, and realizing that if their parents were farming some property, they didn't have that anymore, and here they just are gone all of a sudden. That had to create a fairly emotional environment around here, I'd guess.
Oh, it sure did. in our case, I had an older brother who was 7 years older than I was. It was in the first draft where they were going to be taken and trained for a year and then come home. The final deal on that was that he came home 4.5 years later. He spent a lot of time in Europe. But he did come home, and that's the bottom line on anything, is you go, you do whatever you have to do, and try to keep your head down so you can come home.
Well, really, then, for the first couple years of America's involvement in the war, you had your brother to worry about, and I imagine you thought of him often. Did you guys hear from him very often?
Well, we heard from him some, but he wasn't a real good letter writer. He was in the tank outfit, light tanks. They were sent to Iceland. Kind of a funny place for tanks, but they were to occupy that area so that the Germans couldn't use it to refuel and refurbish their U-boats. The D-Day, he was in England then. I think it was the third day after D-Day their unit was deployed. He was in a recon unit. Light tanks weren't much of a match for the German 88s, so they would send out to find German units and then get away from there, because they didn't stay around very long or they'd be blown up. He did come home on a furlough when I was home on a delay en route to ship out, so I did get to see him just before I went overseas.
Well, and I imagine as you're finishing up high school and he's already in the service and this war is raging, it's probably occurring to you that you're going to have no choice but to do something?
I knew that just as soon as I was 18, I was going to go. That was just the way things were at that time. The particular time when I entered the service, we had been taking quite a bit of casualties in the infantry. So when I went in, everybody that went in that unit went to infantry replacement training, and we were supposed to have 17 weeks of training. Some of the fellows that were ahead of me, maybe 6 months older than I was, didn't get 17 weeks. In fact, I didn't get 17 weeks. One of the fellows was on your program here a few months ago. I think he only had 5 weeks when they were shipped.
So you aren't complaining?
No, I'm not complaining. And we took it seriously because our training officers were quite upfront with us to say, what you guys are learning here, you're going to put to practice. You're either going to, you know, war is the idea is to get them before they get you. You take it very seriously, and because I didn't want them to get me.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't. And I know a few other people are too. And speaking of, before you entered the service, here you are, 18 years old, still here in Reedley. People say you shouldn't get married as a teenager, but 68 years later, I think you have a pretty good success story here. Tell me about how you two met.
Well, I was judging a speech contest, Southmore's, I believe it was. I was a senior, and this young lady really impressed me with just being who she was and the way she acted and everything. I decided that I ought to get really acquainted with her. Well, to begin with, I asked her for a date, and she turned me down. Then I asked her for later another date, and she turned me down. She said she had a good excuse. She just had some teeth pulled or something, but I'm not sure. Maybe she was just playing hard to get or was looking for something better. But then we started dating. I never dated another girl, and she never dated another boy until we were married, and that was about 68 years ago.
Well, and you had some work to do, though, in order to make it back, and you had to trust she was still going to be around. So before you left, and you entered the service in December of 44, just 18 and a half years old, before you went off to training and everything, did you ask Marjorie to wait around for you, or how'd you handle that?
Oh, she asked me. She's not here, so I can say that. No, I never had any other thoughts, but she was the girl I wanted to marry, and I guess she had the similar thoughts about me, because when I was on a delay en route, we had 10 days come home from Camp Roberts and was to report back to be shipped out. we decided to get married. The picture of our wedding is right over there.
And I have that photo along with many others on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you haven't liked the show on Facebook yet, just search for Hometown Heroes Radio. You know, and you mentioned Camp Roberts. We might have some folks listening to us at Camp Roberts right now, and maybe they're saying, yeah, I've spent some time there. That wasn't easy. For you, being a farm boy and someone who grew up having to do a lot of work around the property here, did you find basic training to be less of a challenge, you think, than some of the other guys, or was it tough for you too?
It was tough, but it was certainly less of a challenge for some of us farm boys than some of the more city dudes, because they hadn't had to do any physical labor. Farm work at that point in time was all physical labor. We had to pick peaches. They were picked in boxes. You loaded the boxes on a vineyard truck, took them out to the end of the row, and put them on another truck to go to packing house. So it was all hand work. And now it's we've got forklifts and things that we don't have to do all of the heavy handwork that we used to have to. But it taxed you. Basic training was meant to tax you, to strengthen you. And the main thing, I think, was to train you that when somebody said to do something, you did it. You never asked questions. You just did it. And that's necessary in the military. I didn't like the Army, but I made up my mind I'd be the best soldier I could possibly be. I don't know whether I made it or not, but I was fortunate enough to gain rank pretty quick, so I guess it was something to do with my activities.
I hear a lot of stories, and you've heard them too, if you listen to the program, about the people that guys served with and the connections that were formed. Here are these teenagers putting their lives on the line in this global conflict, but I find a lot of cases where someone made a friend and kept that friend for a long time, and it sounds like that was the case in your experience.
I was inducted up at Camp Beale, then shipped by rail back to Camp Roberts. Well, it was about 10 o'clock at night we got into Camp Roberts and herded into a barracks, and lights were out, but we found bunks, and naturally the guys there were interested in who was in the bed next to them and so forth. We're talking, and a fellow asked me, and he was in the bed next to me, said, where are you from? And I said, well, I'm from California, over in the San Joaquin Valley near Fresno. And a voice came from across the room, said, well, I'm from Hanford. So the next morning, naturally, we were trying to figure out who was from Reedley and who was from Hanford. And we made that connection, and it turned out to be the best friend that a man could ever have. I served with Harry Dooley, and we went through some things that weren't so nice together. And then after we came home, we continued the relationship, and we used to go deer hunting stuff every year. I would say that Harry Dooley was the best friend that I had.
You had friends, and you had enemies, and the enemy was a very real and ever-present threat once you got over to the Philippines. Do you remember what it felt like to head overseas, say goodbye to a teenage bride, to your family, to this hometown that you enjoyed so much? Can you put us in your mind at that point? Tell us what you were thinking, what you were feeling?
Well, it was kind of hollow. We shipped out your knowledge that we weren't going to a picnic. We were going to something that was severe, and a lot of men had already been knocked down. Now, I was on a boat, a troop ship, for 23 or 24 days. Never saw land at any one of those days until, well, I guess the second day before we got to where we were going. We did come off Palau Island, and about a mile, I guess, off the island, and I was looking at, there's land in this water. I noticed there were some little black puffs over in the air. And you looked at it a little closer, and the Japanese were bombing Palau, and we were about a mile offshore, 4,500 men on a troop ship. That evening on Tokyo Rose, which they always had it on the radio, and Tokyo Rose said the USS Harry Taylor was sunk off Palau today with 4,500 men aboard. So evidently they knew we were there, but they didn't come after us.
Well, and, you know, I've had a lot of veterans share some of those Tokyo Rose propaganda stories with me. And a lot of times they didn't know whether or not it was true or false. I mean, they hoped and assumed that it was just a lie. But I guess in your case, you knew that wasn't true because you were still standing on the ship, huh?
Yeah, we were still floating. We were on a good ship. It was the USS Harry Taylor. Was a built for the troop ship. It had two 5-inch guns, one fore and aft, and it had a whole slew of 20-millimeter anti-aircraft and 40-millimeter. They put forth a lot of firepower, so if the Japanese had come over, we would have tried to make them as unwelcome as possible.
And I know there were plenty of times on the island of Luzon in the Philippines where the Japanese made you feel quite unwelcome. Break time. Vernon Conrad of Reedley, California, our guest today. We'll hear about his close calls in World War II when Hometown Heroes continues after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 87-year-old Vernon Conrad. On our Facebook page, you'll find a photo of the uniform he wore during World War II, the Tropic Lightning shoulder patch indicating his service with the 25th Infantry Division. We're going to discuss that, but another photo you'll find online is something else he brought home from the war, a little black book. What's the story behind that?
Well, the church ladies group presented any of the fellows that went in the service with this New Testament and Psalms, and they presented that to me, and that was with me for all the time that I was in the service overseas. It was always in my pocket. I guess I should have had it out reading it more, but it was a good feeling to have it, and I'm certainly thank the Lord that there were a lot of things that happened in my tenure in the service that I just thank the Lord over and over and over, because I know he was taking care of me.
Amen. And I know looking at that Bible is a powerful reminder of that and of all those ladies back here in Reedley that were praying for you that whole time. And I want to ask about some of those moments that you look back on now and feel fortunate. And I imagine some of them came while you were carrying around a big, heavy machine gun called the Browning Automatic Rifle. You were a BAR man in the Philippines?
Right. When we landed in the Lingayen Gulf, here were a whole bunch of, you might say, recruits. They were anticipating in the landing that they would need a lot of replacements. And so we were the replacements. When we got ashore, there were about 50 of us that I guess they didn't know what to do with, so they rounded us up and formed us into what they called a casual company. We were in that casual company for a couple of weeks. Wherever they had a hot spot, they moved us up there in reserve. And I can remember the first night we were taken out to put a perimeter around a Japanese arsenal that they had captured, knowing that Japanese would like to have it back again. I didn't have any trouble sleeping that night at all. I mean, you're supposed to be awake while you're on guard, and I was totally awake, that's for sure. But they didn't get it back. They made a little effort to try to get it back, but our firepower soon discouraged them, and they didn't come in again.
How often did you have to actually fire that BAR?
BAR, I'd like to explain a little bit how it's used in a rifle squad, which 10 or 12 men. You have a couple of scouts that are up front, and then the squad leader, and right behind the squad leader, you have the BAR man, and he's positioned there so that any time there's action, the squad leader can direct the BAR man to wherever to do the most good. That's a weapon that had the most firepower in that group, actually a machine gun, shoulder machine gun with 30-round clips. The BAR man carried several clips, and then two of the wing flankers carried clips for the BAR man. And you weren't really trying to just get rid of a lot of ammunition. You're trying to make it count. I think we did a pretty good job.
As you describe that position, in a way, you have the backs of all these other guys. I could imagine you feeling responsible for protecting them with your bigger, stronger gun. Is that fair to say?
Well, that's true. And there's two, well, you know that the enemy don't like that gun, and so they're going to exert quite a bit of effort to try to put it out of action. As I'd said earlier, the war is you get them before they get you. That was the name of the game.
So you knew you were a significant target of the enemy.
Oh, yeah. You know that soon.
Is there a moment that really illuminated that for you, that was, whoa, this is what I'm in for?
Most of the time, when it became very handy to have a BAR or any machine gun, was when you had perimeters set up and enemy would attack. Why, they certainly would concentrate on any weapon that was firing a lot of rounds. Sometimes we could fire and then move quickly one way or the other, so we wouldn't be in the same position all the time. Most of the time, and at night, you dug a hole, tried to be very careful so that the rain wouldn't come in the hole, but it always did. So, and when it got dark, you didn't get out of that hole, because if you did, one of your own buddies probably shoot you. I might tell you about one incident that we had gone past the Central Luzon Agricultural College, and we had been having quite a bit of contact with the Japanese, and we had a perimeter set up about 4 o'clock in the morning, I guess it was. I heard a person, we had a certain word that you could use, and they recognized it, that you were friendly.
Because you guys had a significant fear, for good reason, of the Japanese coming in your camp in the middle of the night, right?
A lot of the Japanese could speak just as good English as I could. But in this case, this person gave the password, and I watched him very carefully. He came and dropped in the hole with me. And when he did, I noticed that he had something shiny on his collar. He talked to me for, I guess he was there for 20 minutes and congratulating us on what occurred a few days earlier, and it just turned out that it was General Dalton, our assistant division commander. That's a experience I don't think too many dog faces have had.
Yeah, and I'm sure you've reflected back on that a lot over the years and thought, boy, there are a lot of different ways that could have happened, because you're ready to take him out if he didn't have the right word to say, right?
You don't wait too long, you know. He who hesitates is lost.
Yeah.
So he was assistant division commander, and he had a reputation of wherever there was hot spots, that's where he would be. The men just loved him. Sorry to say he got killed about 2 or 3 weeks after that. Sniper got him.
Well, and I'm sure that had an impact on you with the interaction, that encounter that you guys had had in the dark of night in that foxhole. But I also am guessing that's not the only time that you had to deal with loss. And I'm sure you saw those guys that you served very closely with gunned down on the battlefield. How did you deal with that? How did that impact you?
Well, I don't know how to say that. I was fortunate that I never had any of my close buddies. They got buggered up a little bit, but none were killed. And we had one occurrence that Japanese were occupying the high ground, and we were moving up this canyon, and I thought to myself that we're getting awful close to the front here, and Japanese had caves that they were in, and they'd roll their artillery out and fire a few rounds and then pull it back in the cave, and our artillery would respond, but as soon as we'd quit firing, why, they'd roll theirs back out, and an evac hospital right across the road from where I was, they blew it all to pieces, and that was one of the toughest times I had.
How often did you find yourself thinking, what if I'm next? What if I don't see another day? Did your mind go there, or did you somehow prevent yourself from those thoughts?
Well, I would guess the first day after we landed and we got organized, why, we had communion. This might be kind of strange for some people, but the chaplain was an army chaplain. He happened to be a Catholic, but he had three services for all of the men. He had a Catholic service, and then he had a Protestant service, and then he had another service for those that didn't have any professed religion. I think that's the most meaningful service of that type that I ever had, because he really spoke some good words about, you know, you need to confess your sins and get right with God. And so if you do happen to fall, you'll be in good hands. So I determined right at that point in time that whatever would be, and I put myself in God's hands, and I've been there ever since.
Amen. And it sounds like he's been pretty faithful to you. When you think back on that time on Luzon, and this is hotly contested ground in the Philippines at the tail end of World War II, are there a moment or two that you look back now and say, yeah, that was a pretty close call? Yeah, I easily could have gone down that day. What are the closest calls that you remember?
Well, I guess the closest call was something that shouldn't have happened. In our company, we had a number of 2.5-ton trucks that the whole division used. We sent a division service officer, or transportation officer, would call and say, I want two trucks at the pickup, artillery or shells or something. And in this particular instance, we had ring mounts over the cab, 50 caliber machine guns mounted on them. And so we had a driver and a guy riding shotgun. I was selected to ride shotgun on this occurrence. And we took a load of 105 howitzer shells and started looking for where they were supposed to go. The guy that was driving, he wasn't someone who paid close attention to things. We were told we'd go up this Highway 5, which was just a cow trail, was all it was, and there'd be an MP there, then he would tell us to go, which on this other road. We drove up there, and there wasn't any MP. The driver disagreed with me that was the road we should have taken, so he went on, and we drove right into the front, I guess you would call it. Sniper took a shot at the driver. He missed the driver, and he nicked me. It just went underneath the skin, a bullet in my leg. I guess you'd say that's the closest call. If he'd have gotten, you know, an inch or two the other way, he'd done more damage. It didn't take us long to get backed up and back down the hill and around where we were supposed to go.
I imagine you were pretty scared at that moment, especially considering your cargo. I mean, a well-placed shot, and you guys are up in flames, huh?
Fear isn't the word for it. Anybody that tells you they're not afraid in circumstances like that, I can point out a liar to you.
So you survived that one, and as you've mentioned, you survived a lot of things. But as you guys are getting your job done on Luzon and other forces are doing their work elsewhere, we're getting close to the end of the war, but you guys don't know that. And as infantrymen, you had the very real prospect of maybe the biggest battle of them all on the horizon?
No question about it. It would have been a tremendous bloodbath if we had had to make that invasion.
And you guys knew this. You were told, we're going to invade Japan.
Oh, yeah. We were told we're going to invade Japan, and we were told that they expected that there'd be at least 1 million casualties in that invasion, and probably 5 million Japanese people would be killed. And one thing I always appreciated about our officers and stuff, they were up front. They never hid anything. Or in fact, they told us when we were to attack something that we could expect a lot of resistance or things wouldn't be easy. But we come back and went into intense training. All of our equipment had been waterproofed so you could drive it in water. We took the fan belts off so the fans didn't throw water back on the ignition. At that time, I had been not only a company welder, but I was also assistant motor sergeant. Training that we had is how do we get it ashore and all. The war was over, and our unit was selected to occupy the area around Nagoya and to destroy all of the ability for the Japanese to wage war. Most of the men were loaded on APAs. Two of us were left there. I was assistant motor sergeant and the motor sergeant, and we were to get all of our vehicles loaded onto LSTs. No LSTs showed up. And we waited and waited. Back 3 days later, why they showed up. We got our equipment on, got it tied down good. We started for Japan, and we were off Okinawa when a storm hit us, and a storm that the Navy says they have never have record for that severe a storm in that area. We lost one LCI. There were three LSTs and two LCIs, the landing craft infantry. It capsized and went down, and I'm sure there wasn't anybody saved. Waves were 50, 60 feet high, and it wasn't anything you could do. Well, of course, I went below and stayed there.
What were you doing? So I'm thinking, what did that feel like? Here you've survived the war, all this combat at close range with the Japanese, and now a storm's going to take you out? What were you doing down below deck?
Praying, that's what I was doing. No, that sure went across my mind. I had several opportunities to be taken out in the Philippines, and it didn't happen. And now, after the war is over, am I going to be sucked under by the water? It was a tremendous storm and really tore up the Okinawa, the island. They got all of the ships that they could out of the harbor, and those that they couldn't get out of the harbor, they put all of the anchors that they had down. The wind still blew the ships, dragging the anchors clear across the harbor. And the bad part about it, the storm went out, circled around, and then came back and blew those ships back to the other side of the harbor. It really destroyed a lot of things. But we survived it, and where we landed, the long, narrow inlet on the other side of a peninsula from Nagoya. I was on the lead LST, and there was a minesweeper ahead of us, and we got in fairly close to where they were going to push the LSTs up against the bank. Came around and said they wanted volunteers to go ashore. And the cardinal rule in the service is you never volunteer for anything. But I was so anxious to get off that boat that I volunteered.
We'll find out what that meant when we come back, plus an involuntary twist of fate like so many we hear about on Hometown Heroes. The rest of Vernon Conrad's story right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest is 87-year-old Vernon Conrad of Reedley, California. If that's your hometown, you can find him just about every Sunday morning at Cornerstone Community Church there. He thinks the organist in that church is pretty good. He better. That's his wife of 68 years, Marjorie. But when we left off, Vern hadn't made it home to see his young bride yet. He was headed to Japan for occupation duty.
Well, I was in the first squad to go ashore in Wakayama. There were 10 of us on a small boat, got ashore, And for about 4 hours, we went on a patrol. No guns, just walking patrol. I guess they were sent us out there as guinea pigs to see if there's going to be any resistance, which there wasn't. And in fact, I never saw a Japanese person in that 4 hours. You knew they were there, but they were so hunkered down that we never saw them. And went back, and they run the LST right up against the bank, let the big door in front down, and we landed in Japan.
And how long did you stay over there in Japan before you got to come home?
I was there for a year. That time had a point system. You got points for certain things. And a lot of the men at that time had been in, you know, overseas for long periods of time. One of the fellows that I replaced had been overseas for 5 years, never been home. We were there for the duration. That's right.
And you have some good photos from that time period. And one of the photos shows you and a bunch of other soldiers standing at attention as a very familiar face walks by to inspect you. Was it nervous to have General Eisenhower looking you up and down and making sure you were doing everything right?
It sure was. At that point in my life, a general was, it just made you shake in your boots, you know. Even when you saw the car go by with those red flags on the front, why, you snapped to attention. And since then, I have two fellows that I count in my friendship. They're one two-star general and one one-star general, and I find they put their pants on one leg at a time just like I do, but... When you're young and you're trained to do things, you do them.
Do you remember him saying anything to all the troops there, or was it something that mattered to you at the time?
Oh, yeah, he came by where I was. He never said anything, but in two or three times he did stop and talk to a soldier, ask him questions, you know, how's the food and things like that. He was interested in the well-being of the soldiers there. Not too many of the fellas wanted to speak up, you know. But he did show a real concern for the troops.
Well, and I know one of your concerns was getting home to that wife you'd only had a couple weeks with as a married couple before you shipped out. I understand that year you had in Japan gave you time to go diving for oysters. You brought home a pearl for her?
I visited Mikimoto Pearl Farm in Japan. That's the fellow who developed cultural pearls. He was 97 years old when we was there. Say, I became acquainted with an English lady who was married to a Japanese doctor. Her husband, this Kanoshita, asked us one day if we would like to, and my buddy would like to, go to Mikimoto Pearl Farm. Naturally, we would. The problem was that we weren't allowed to go past a certain distance from our base. We had freedom to even take vehicles and sightsee within a certain length of time, but this was over 75 miles. So we had to go to our company commander and get written permission that we could take a vehicle. So we went down there and went through the whole operation. One of the last things, we went out on a boat where they were diving for the oysters, placed a little mother-of-pearl stone in these oysters when they were small, and then they'd take them out in this lagoon and put them down on it's about 10, 12 feet of water. 4 or 5 years later, they'd go and dive and get these oysters. The divers were all girls. They said the girls could stay down longer than men could. They would go down with a little bucket deal, put all the oysters in it that they could get, and come back up and dump those oysters in a tub that was floating. And each one of us, they gave us a tub with all these oysters in it. When we got back to the shore, why, then we opened up our oysters, and any of the pearls in there were we could have. So I was fortunate. I got some real nice pearls in my tub, brought them home to my wife, had a jeweler make a ring with two nice pearls on it, a necklace with the largest pearl on it, set of earrings.
So you didn't come home empty-handed. What was that moment like to see her again after all that time and all those close calls where you weren't sure you're going to make it home?
Well, I don't know. You can't describe the first time you see a person you love for a year. It just overwhelming. I want to say that she didn't really recognize me when I got home.
That sounds like a problem.
I had contracted malaria in the Philippines, and I had lost a lot of weight. I weighed around 200 pounds when we were married, and when I came home, I was less than 180. She recognized my buddy, Harry Dooley, so she knew I was going to be there somewhere. And finally, she spotted me, and of course, there was probably 1,000 GIs. When we came back, they were bringing in men as fast as they could to discharge them. When we got to Camp Beale again, there weren't any beds. So they said, all you guys that live in California, you take a 3-day pass and go home. And we did. Well, from Marysville here, it takes almost a day and a day going back, so I went back 3 days and asked the lieutenant there, give us a 10-day pass, make it worthwhile. And he said, I can't do that. I said, well, what happens if we don't come back for 10 days? You know, nothing if you keep your nose clean and don't get in trouble with MPs. So I came home, went back about, 8 days later. First time I was AWOL during my Army, our luck had run out because they changed commanding officers and we were AWOL. There probably was 50 guys in there that were all in the same situation. Lieutenant got up there and gave us a big speech and give us a choice. You could have company punishment or you could have a court-martial. Well, that wasn't much of a choice. So I got on the garbage detail. They hadn't pulled our names off of the roster. The way they worked there, they over the loudspeakers, they just called out a roster, and if your name was on it, you fell into a certain place. We were picking up garbage and heard our names called. Needless to say, we abandoned ship.
Well, I know it's a long time ago, and a lot has happened since. You've grown a lot of fruit out here in Reedley since, and there are 2 kids and 4 grandkids and 3 great-grandkids I know are real happy you came home from the war. But when you think back on it now, what are the things that you're most thankful for, that you're most proud of even?
I'm proud that I served my country, and I'm proud of my family and my wife in particular, who's been the strongest supporter I've had. I thank God that things have worked out like they have. We didn't cut a very big swath, but we've had a good life and good family. It's been a good ride.
Sure sounds like it. Well, on behalf of all our listeners, I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for serving our community for all these years as well. And I can't miss an opportunity for those of us who'd like to be able to say one day we've been married for 68 years. I got to ask you your secret. How have you pulled that off?
Just learn how to say yes, ma'am. No, it's been a give and take, and like my wife says, divorce and never considered it. Murder, time or two, yes.
Good thing you had experience dodging bullets, huh?
Yeah. No, my wife has been very easy to live with. She's not been demanding or anything, and we've tried to both be somewhat the same and recognize your partner's feelings and thank God for the opportunity that we've had to live together.
Well said. I hope you'll hop on Facebook and punch in Hometown Heroes Radio. You can see what Vern and Marjorie Conrad looked like then and what they look like now. You can see his World War II uniform. He says it's shrunk a little over the years. He donated 1 Japanese sword to the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor in downtown Fresno, and he still has a samurai sword also. That photo's up too. But before we wrap it up, let's go back to the Philippines. You can see a couple moments where things could have ended up a lot differently for you. Somehow, your destiny was changed. Tell me about that.
When they moved us from this casual company up to 25th Division, we went up there with on our narrow gauge railroad. It was middle of the night when we arrived at where our destination. Rain like fits. It did that quite often in the Philippines. lieutenant called a roster out for guys to go to the signal company. And they started in A's and B's and C's. They didn't call my name. And then they called the Nadis. They called my buddy, Dooley. My heart really dropped because I felt this is where we split. We'd been together all the time since we'd been in the Army. When they got clear through to the end of the roster, he came back and called Conrad. And the only thing that I can possibly think that the good Lord just protected me at that point in time.
And the story of how you ended up being a welder goes a lot like that, too. You were training to climb palm trees.
We were a construction section which laid lines and kept the lines open and repaired them. Took us out and we were training to climb palm trees so we could put some of the wires up in the trees, particularly where the heavy traffic areas were. And which I didn't think too much of that because I'm a pretty good sized guy and I thought I'd make an awful good target up in those trees. And
so they were looking for a volunteer for a welder?
Yeah, the first sergeant came out there and said, any of you guys know how to weld? And of course I didn't volunteer and nobody else did. And so finally he was standing right beside me. So I said, I know how to weld, but I'm not a certified welder. And he said, come with me. So then I became the company welder at that point in time. And most of my duties was near the division headquarters from then on. That's where we usually set up, is division headquarters had set up, and then we'd set up fairly close to division headquarters. I had real good duty. I repaired everything, enjoyed it a lot. Thankful that I paid attention when I was in high school and learned how to weld, because I'd have probably been carrying a rifle in the mud otherwise.
And you'd had a taste of that. So in a way, it's possible that welding and you're having paid attention and you're volunteering saved your life?
Could have very easily. When you're in a combat area, you have all kinds of opportunities to get hit. But I'm just thankful that those opportunities were minimized.
I don't blame you. Thanks again. That's Vernon Conrad. Check out the pictures on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And hey, get out to Clovis Friday night and support Central Valley Honor Flight by eating a little ice cream, or a lot of ice cream. Honor Flight takes World War II veterans to Washington, D.C. free of charge so they can see their memorial. And this coming Friday, August 16th, the Farmers Market in Old Town Clovis will feature an ice cream eating contest. Who doesn't like the sound of that? It's $10 to enter, and every penny will go to Central Valley Honor Flight. Thanks to Bill and Cora Shipley of the Old Hotel Bistro and Heart's Delight. That's definitely worth the drive to Clovis this coming Friday night. We're out of time for now, though. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.